Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I, as always, am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, Amanda Waltz.
Hi, Brian.
Hi. You saw Magic Mike XXL.
I did.
What'd you think of it?
Well, my friend and I definitely freaked out during the infamous Nine Inch Nails dance sequence.
Okay. Is that so, the nails were not the only thing that were 9 inches?
It was unexpected. Thank you, Brian.
You're welcome. Nick Newman, also with us today. Nick Newman, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Glad to hear it. So today...
Magic Mike XXL is great, by the way. Just saying that. Okay,
okay. So that's on record. I haven't seen it
yet. It was enjoyable.
That's two goes, and one I haven't gone yet, so I don't know what to tell you.
I will say the more movies with a Channing Tatum drug scene, the better.
So you could tie your shoes and make a girl's fucking year.
I could have told you that from both of the Jump Street movies.
Oh, Jump Street? Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Such a talented man.
He's great. He's great in a drug trip. Mm-hmm. So we've been gone for a couple weeks. That is because of Danny King for the first week and then me for the second week. Danny King is not here today, so I'm going to say that's a win for me. That's about it as far as an explanation for that. We are here today. We will be talking about Eden, the newest film from Mia Hansen-Love. Before we get into that, allow me to say you should write us a review on iTunes, give us a comment and a rating, let us know how we're doing. You can also email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com and follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show.
Well, also Facebook.
Yeah, Facebook is the Film Stage.
Oh,
but not
the
show itself. I mean, like, okay. we're looking out for number one right now.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough.
We run this website. Don't let Jordan hear that.
Don't let Jordan hear that?
Yeah, no.
Let's assume he doesn't listen to this podcast.
No, he definitely never listens to this podcast. Speaking of film websites, sad news this week, The Dissolve shut down. For anyone who doesn't know, thedissolve.com was a movie website that was run by Pitchfork. It had some fantastic writers for it. A lot of whom came from the AV Club after that got shooken up. So, guys, should we just stop doing this? Like, is that a sign? Like, does no one give a shit? If The Dissolve can't make it.
Yeah, I got a little suspect when Nathan Rabin started writing for the AV Club again.
Right. Well, there was a day when it was like, oh, I'm going to still freelance for him, but I'm no longer, like, staff at The Dissolve. And I was like, ooh, boy, but he's, like, my favorite writer there.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that guy. His My World and Year of Flops at the AV Club and his Forgotbusters for The Dissolve, they were great.
Well, I mean, I think it was probably, I don't know. I enjoyed it. I even listened to their podcast quite a bit, which I've listened to very few film podcasts, so that's really saying something. But I don't know, man. I mean, if they can't make it, can any of us?
I don't know. Nick, can any of us make it?
I know people who do, but it's not easy. It requires, first, a great deal of talent. Secondly, knowing the right people who like you. I'm talking about, you know, doing it respectably. There are plenty of, you know, I mean, just like a bunch of bad websites have been getting bought by big companies in the past couple of months.
Yeah.
And it just sort of makes my heart sink.
You want to name drop any?
If I say that... is a bad website and is a bad website, does that get cut from here, or do I what if I say that but it does not represent the views of the Film Stage or the Film Stage Show, solely me?
I can just cut it out. I was just curious.
Okay,
we can put an asterisk next to
I will say comment. That I've gone to and that is a shit fucking website.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, It
feels like it should give your computer a virus, doesn't it?
It does. I honestly hate going there on anything but my phone, because I'm sure it's going to give me a virus. Anyway, so yeah, there's a lot that goes into making it. And, you know, the Dissolve was one of my favorites because they didn't pander. They didn't, you know, post, oh, here's a picture of Ben Affleck on the set of Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, let's speculate. They did really thoughtful essaying and criticism. They brought a lot of attention to films that some people might not have known about. They straddled a line of populism and actual critical content, and they failed. I mean,
they're still going to write.
They're still going to write, but I mean, like, yeah. If, it's just that thing again. Like, if the Dissolve can't make it, what hope do any of us have?
Oh, Brian.
Guys, I'm going through a thing right now.
I don't know. I'm not so pessimistic. I think that there is a way to do it. It's just, you know, it's not easy. Listicles. You got to strike a balance. Well,
yeah, you
sure,
do have to strike a balance.
But listicles don't. See, I exceedingly dislike this idea that listicles are a bad form of writing just because of the format. I mean, you can fit great writing and insightful criticism into that sort of easily digestible format.
I mean, like, cracked.com
I think there are ways
is great
to do
with
it.
The in-depth listicle. But that's because, like, they do, like, a real honest-to-God article with a list.
Yeah.
Like, I'm talking more like, this is how we felt about Game of Thrones in 30 Kim Kardashian GIFs.
Here's a six-page breakdown of the 45-second Star Wars trailer.
Yeah, like, frame by
which
frame.
Which does exist.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
That is a thing.
So
there's,
bad.
There's a website that's been doing that, and just, like, every trailer that comes out, scene by scene, you know, what can we garner from it? You know, I won't lie. I read it. I read it because I want to know about that film. I'm not blameless here, but I also read The Dissolve. Religiously. I mean, like, it's to the point now where when I turn on my computer first thing in the morning, there's like a 5-minute gap in my content reading because The Dissolve isn't there anymore.
Yeah.
It's sad.
Well, even IndieWire, I know Nigel Smith just left for Grantland? No, not Grantland. I can't remember.
The Guardian.
So, okay,
the Guardian.
Yeah. The Guardian. And so I'm wondering, I don't know what's up with IndieWire as well.
IndieWire, which is reporting from Comic-Con this week.
Woo!
This is just the podcast where I burn every bridge, isn't it? Let's do it. Let's go.
Talking about not having a future, Nick Newman currently destroying any avenue towards expansion in the future.
Hey, Nick, tell us what you think about Entertainment Weekly while you're at it. Village Voice? Yeah, take him down.
Oh, who cares about them? They'll be fine.
I actually have a friend
Village
who...
Voice. Hey, Danny King writes for the Village Voice, so it's okay by me.
Yeah, my friend Dan Gvozden writes for the Village Voice. He was on this podcast to talk about the Avengers, Age of Ultron. And, I mean, he left Maryland, went all the way to L.A. to do a graduate program, and had been spending, like, every free moment talking to every, you know, media writer that he could, and literally all of them said, don't bother. It's incredibly difficult to make a living on this, and your future's never assured. And he actually posted, like, a 1,000-word Facebook post that was basically, like, a giant existential sorrow fest. And I get it, man, because it's rough out there.
Well, I know when I went to grad school... Yeah, that was because I went for arts journalism, and every single panel, every single discussion we had was, oh, what's the future of journalism? What's the future of film criticism? What's the future of music criticism? And it was just so, I'm like, okay, I can we just not talk about this anymore? Can we not speculate?
How long can you
on
talk
the...
about something that doesn't exist? There is no future.
Well, it's just, can we stop? I don't know. It was just one of those things. And we would have panels come in from like the New York Times, and they would basically just be like, we don't know what we're doing.
When I was in journalism school from 2005 to 2009, it was basically like every year my classes got smaller and smaller because more and more people got scared off and, you know, went to do business or engineering like a smart person, like a fucking intelligent person with a sense of self-preservation and a desire for financial stability. I'm not bitter. I'm not sad. I hear about the billions being made on a shittily written self-published erotica, and I've got a novel and a half sitting on my hard drive that I'll never be able to sell. You know what? Let's just stop. Let's just not
Brian.
Even do this podcast. I'm just going to get drunk.
Wow. Okay. Well,
this has been the Film Stage Show. Signing off forever.
I should think this is an appropriate intro for Eden.
It is.
Speaking of giving up on your dreams.
Speaking of toiling diligently for a fucking decade or more and having very little to show for it, let's talk about Eden, the newest film by Mia Hansen-Love. Eden is about a young DJ named Paul who, beginning in 1992, attempts to make it in the world of garage music, which is a form of electronic music that was popular in Paris, apparently. Maybe it was popular here. I don't know.
I think it was the 1880s. Oh my God. 1980s.
Yeah, I know.
There's a lot of harpsichord. He actually explains what it is at some point.
It started in the 80s, and he seemed to be doing well with it. Anyway, here's the trailer. We'll talk about the movie.
Forget about New York. Paris is much more fun. Please stay. Celebration. I'll be a DJ. One more time. We'll be rich. One more time. Do you like it?
I mean, it's great to dance to, but I don't know that I would listen to it every day at home. One more time.
Faut absolument que t'arrêtes tes conneries, que tu te consacres à tes études maintenant. One
more time. So this is Eden. Nick Newman actually wrote the Film Stage review of Eden way back in the halcyon years of 2014, back when The Dissolve was still putting out quality content on a daily basis, when he saw it at the New York Film Festival. So Nick Newman, why don't you kick us off? What is your opinion of Eden?
My opinion of Eden is a very high one, as it so happens. Yeah, I saw this all the way back in late September of 2014 at the New York Film Festival, where I also interviewed Mia Hansen-Love, and
which is also on the Film Stage.
Yeah, it is, and I should note that in June I spoke with her brother Sven Hansen-Love, the co-writer of the film and whose experiences this film is based upon. And I like the way those two interviews kind of sync up, because I transcribed both Mia Hansen-Love, and then I sort of use that as the jumping off point for the other one. So, you know, regardless of anything else, from me you can get an extensive view of how the film was created, if nothing else. But I'll try to give you something else. So, you know, when we talked about Clouds of Sils Maria, it was briefly mentioned the fact that she is, in fact, Olivier Assayas's wife, having acted in his film late August, early September. And it is I think it is with no small reason that many people have noted the similarities between their work. It is not just because of that spousal relationship, but in fact because I think they have very similar purposes. She's only directed four features now, but each one of them ranges from very good to excellent. And I think part of it is because she has a very deep understanding of not only what allows her characters to function as people, it makes them function as people, but all of the different possibilities that a single situation can create for that person. And the way her films are structured usually is spanned over an extended period of time between two separate parts. And Eden is no different. It goes from something like 1991 to 2013, I believe. And through that time, the main character, Felix, played by Paul de Givry, does not age, as is noted in the movie, I think to comedic effect. There's a moment where Greta Gerwig's character, who she's basically making a cameo in this movie. I don't want people to listen to this and think they're, you know, getting another Frances Ha or something, because it's nothing like that. But she says something to the effect of, you know, it's weird. it's like you never change. And yeah. when I saw the movie at the New York Film Festival, the audience, which I from what I could tell was otherwise responding to it pretty positively, let out a big laugh at that line. And I think it's an intentional thing, because she has said something to the effect that she didn't want to distract from things like old age makeup and him having
but
to
he could have gotten a haircut or something or grown a beard.
He does get facial hair, and
oh, it's like he forgot to shave for a day.
Well, no, but he gets facial hair and his hair changes a bit, and I think that she has a lot of faith in sort of the emotion of the performer to communicate that sense of change. And I think it comes through in just how hollowed out he becomes after a certain point. It's interesting how the second half of this movie is called
Lost in Music.
And I was trying to remember if that was the name of the first half or not. Again, it's been a while. But anyway, it's called Lost in Music. And what I find funny is how there isn't really the typical, ascendancy, great time, peak, subsequent downfall, because there was never really much of a peak for this guy. And if you look at the movie, it's not as if his life becomes really, really terrible. He's not turning tricks in a gas station bathroom or something.
Spoiler alert, there are no trick turnings in this movie.
Yes. Basically what happens is he does a few too many drugs. He runs out of money and he says, okay, I should probably change things. And he does, but even when he changes things, it's not really that significant. He, takes a poetry class and he meets a cute girl who maybe might be interested in him and with whom something might happen. And then the movie kind of ends.
So, spoiler alert, I guess, at that point.
I guess I'm really fascinated in part by this movie because I think what Hanson Love does is formally, the films are very lavishly designed, in the sense that in terms of shooting and editing, it is very kind of showy. It is very obviously a work of cinema. It feels very, I hate this term, but it feels cinematic. It feels like something that is emblematic or rather specific to the medium. And yet, I think that what she does when she's working with performers and characters, it feels more like she's recording them than filming them. And when I say that, I mean it feels more like she's just letting the things be observed. And I don't know if the term is so much naturalistic because it is quote-unquote stylized. There's kind of this weird balance that's struck there between allowing you to sort of observe the natural points of a person's life and also being, again, stylized. I mean, I think the heart of this movie is a montage sequence set to Daft Punk's One More Time in New York in 2001. And I remember when I saw it, thinking that that was kind of the movie encapsulated in a whole. It was this very, it's this very fast cut, sort of thrilling sequence set to a propulsive song. And it feels kind of odd in the context of this movie, but it does encapsulate a lot of it. It gets a lot of the emotions through in a time span of 3 or 4 minutes. And I think the sequence is actually pretty haunting. This sort of generation-defining song is used to denote that things might never be this good again, because there's kind of this sense of dread that's hanging over it. This idea that things are going to change, and it's not going to be for the better, because you're going to get older, and people are going to stop paying attention to you, and you're not going to be as good looking, and unless you'll get a little more weird. Unless you're Paul.
Paul is always good looking.
No, he's still good looking at the end. He is, but he's getting older, and it's getting to the point where girls don't really fall into his lap. He's kind of hobbling around a bit more. There's a lot to
He's geriatric. Let's just say it.
Yes.
Yeah, it was weird that they didn't do age makeup, but they did give him a walker.
How much different do you think people look from what he's like 20 to 34? I mean,
I watched a goddamn movie, a home movie that I shot on a camping trip last night from 9 years ago, and I look like a completely different fucking person.
Well, that's because you've destroyed your body with alcohol, Brian.
This is true. Yeah. I'm just saying, like, some people, but no one in this movie changes.
That's true.
Gerwig has a pregnancy going on. That's a change, but who?
Louise does. His very gemmy.
Oh, yeah, she changes her hair color a couple times.
Well, she has a mom body.
Mom too. Bod.
She's got a mom bod. I mean, sorry,
not his dad bod.
That's
sorry,
fine.
Guys.
That's fine. No. I'll let others take over. I'll just say that, the movie has affected me pretty deeply, and I find it interesting how the worst formal sort of like mark on this movie is brought up again at the end, and it's completely reconfigured, and what would seem like a stupid gimmick becomes devastating and haunting. And when I saw this movie, you know, I saw it at the Walter Reed Theater, and then I had to go back to school, which was, you know, about like 45 minutes away, and I just had to go on with like the rest of my day having seen this scene, and it just really sat with me in a way that I wasn't comfortable with. But
that's,
I'm glad
like
it made
me comfortable.
The time
I had to go to a dance party immediately after having finished watching Amore by Michael Haneke.
Mm.
Oof.
I was not in a party mood.
Yeah.
I did drink a lot, though. So, the going into what Amanda was saying.
Yeah.
Bless your heart, Brian.
I drink a lot.
Anyway, yeah, Eden, it's one of my favorites of the year so far. Unless it's a really outstanding, you know, next 6 months, I'm pretty certain it'll end up on my top 10 list. So,
all right,
there we go.
Cool. Awesome.
I'm going to say that I disagree with about 75% of the things that you said, but we'll get to that. Amanda and Waltz, let's hear what you thought first.
Okay. Well,
if our ratio of agreement is any better,
you're really like getting people like, you know, riled up, getting people like, oh, I can't wait to hear what Brian
it's
says about
tease.
This movie.
Look, I'm nothing if I'm not a showman.
Well, it's strange, Nick, that you said that there's a sense of dread in the film. I never quite felt that. I will say that there was I think it was around the scene you pointed out in the 2001 in New York. It did feel very listless. It is a very listless film, which I think is appropriate. For sure. I mean, because it is it's a film that basically shows that what starts out as your art at some point has to become your career, and making that into a business is incredibly difficult. And it's some people just can't do both. You know, it just never really transitions into it, or they just can't accept that maybe they're not made for it. But it's interesting because, yeah, like you said too, Nick, I noticed a lot of devices that she used that were very similar to Clouds of Sils Maria, like the, you know, it's in chapters and there's a lot of fade to black, and I thought the editing was very reminiscent of Clouds of Sils Maria, but it didn't feel derivative. Like you said, I didn't feel like, oh, she's just copying the style. Because she also has some really, I actually really liked the scenes, the split screens where he's reading, at one point he's reading the Dear John letter from Greta Gerwig's character, and she appears and she's directly addressing the character. I liked that. I actually did like that a lot. Because it was so different from everything else. Like you said, Nick, it has such a naturalistic quality that was, it kind of took you out of the film for a second, and it was, I don't know, I
just
thought
like
it was
the bird at the beginning.
That bird, I didn't like the bird. I'll admit, I didn't like the animated bird. But I understood what I understood the symbolism, but I just didn't care.
I didn't. I didn't care so much that I didn't even bother for the symbolism.
Well, it's just one of those movies where, and I will say one thing about this film that I really, really appreciate is that I really think it captured what it actually is like to go to a giant dance party. There's so many films that try, like filming a dance, like a big club scene, anything like that is a bitch. Like, it is very difficult to do convincingly, and I really think that she did that. There was one point, I can't remember, I think it was when the duo cheers, I think maybe it was the first time that they perform at a club, and there's a really long pan over the crowd, and I just thought it looked great. I thought the lighting looked wonderful. But you know, it's just one of those things where that's like, there was so, but then there was so much of that where it, obviously it came to a head where it was like, oh, we're at this club and like we're on top of the world and everything's going great, and then it keeps going down, 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 where it's like he's playing smaller clubs and he's like basically playing at a wedding where there's like five people. So, and there's just so many moments in the film where you knew he wasn't doing well. Like, you know, when you're popping your own balloons after the party's over, like after your gig's over, you're not doing well. Like, so just things like that where it was like, it's kind of like one of the reviews I was reading was like he's trying to live this rock star lifestyle, but it's not in this conventional way or like the way you would think of it, where, you know, it's this very slow spiral down a drain. It's like, and to a point where, you know, this is what happens, where like you start out just having fun and, you know, you snort a couple lines of coke, and then of course it becomes an addiction and it gets worse and worse, but it doesn't happen like all at once. It's not this, you know, and I think it does that very, very convincingly as well, where I'm like, yeah, I could see how this could kind of get out of control, but at the same token, it's not melodramatic. It's like you said, Nick, like he kind of realizes like, you know, I need to like get my life back in order. I need to figure out what's going on. So, I mean, it's just one of those films where it's not reaching for, and I really think that the part of the movie where they're watching Showgirls was really telling. I thought that was a nice little, like, this is not what we're doing, you guys. So, and also it's very French to be like, Showgirls is art. The French love it.
Of course they do. It's satirizing the gauche culture of the Americans.
American vulgarity. I was like, yeah, French people.
That and the scene where they're having breakfast and they're literally just ripping a baguette apart. The most
like
French fucking shit in the world.
I was seriously like drooling during that scene because she's
make
like,
the bread looks so good.
I don't know, man.
Well, was anyone distracted by the guy at the table looking like a French Neil Hamburger? No. You know Greg Turkington, who plays Neil Hamburger?
Yeah.
So I can't remember his name, but he's kind of an important figure in the movie. He's the paunchy balding guy.
Yeah, yeah.
He looks exactly like Greg Turkington. He plays Neil Hamburger,
<That's>
which I just thought was odd. But anyway.
Well, he is. I don't even really understand. Is he their producer? Or is he? He's another.
He's like a friend of theirs who runs the magazine Eden, isn't he?
No, maybe. I can't remember. I'm thinking
of Arnaud. I don't know who you all are talking about, because that's the guy I think.
Yeah, that's
like
who I'm thinking of. Yeah. Well, your dude Brady was in this too, Brian.
I was watching this movie while my girlfriend was playing Skyrim, and I literally said out loud,
"I love your girlfriend."
What was that?
I love your girlfriend because she plays Skyrim.
Oh yeah, we've had to like create a schedule of switching on and off when we get to play. She was happy that I had to watch a movie and then do this podcast.
Very nice.
Took me off the PlayStation. So we she was playing Skyrim. I was watching this movie, and the second Brady Corbet showed up, I was like, "Fucking Brady Corbet!"
And he's fantastic because he's like
Brady Corbet.
He's like, "Water, yeah, man, fucking hot, am I right?" So over
no,
the top.
No, it's just a Prada sweater. It's cool.
He's fantastic. He's so would play a wonderful serial killer.
He fucking did.
Wait, when?
Simon Killer.
Oh boy!
Did you not see that movie?
No, I did not, but
no,
now I'm going to.
I love Brady. Brady, well, I'm on a first-name basis with him, by the way. Whenever Brady shows up in a movie, I'm just like, there he goes. There goes Brady. He found another foreign director and was like, "Hey, I got 3 days. You want to throw me something?" And they're like, "Sure, you can be this
guy." I saw the trailer for Saint Laurent the other day, and I was like, "God, oh, look at you."
Is he in that?
Yeah.
He's in Brady.
It's like an extended scene. I mean, it's just one scene, but it's kind of a long, it's a very verbose scene too.
I was surprised to see him in two different settings in this film, because usually like shows up for just like, we're only going to use you on this one set, and in this one he was in an apartment and then at a party, and I was like, wow, he got two shots in. That's great.
The most indie couple ever, Greta Gerwig and Brady Corbet together.
Match made in heaven.
Very wonderful. Which Greta Gerwig, I will say, I'm not a fan of Greta Gerwig.
Like, neither am I. High five.
What? I remember seeing her. I remember seeing her in House of the Devil, in the Ty West horror movie House of the Devil, and being like, "Who is this cool ass chick? She is so awesome. She's so charismatic. It's so wonderful." And every movie I've seen her since then, I think I told someone one time, like, she has the personality of a doorknob. I just can't.
Welcome to Frances Ha. Just ugh.
I just can't. She's too much of like, I don't know. Like, I think she's been molded into this like boring white guy dream girl where I'm just I kind of feel bad.
Yeah. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I'm down to just spend the rest of this podcast badmouthing Greta Gerwig.
Have you seen Frances Ha?
Yeah, I didn't like it. I fucking hated it. With
thank God.
Every fiber of my being.
I can't even go back and listen to the episode that we recorded about that because I remember hating it so much and no one understanding.
I can't listen to it because it's one of your worst displays of critical behavior. But otherwise, you know,
have you listened to Kimiko?
I still feel like I was better during Kimiko because I was applying myself critically to that. Whereas Frances Ha, I just hated her so much that I didn't bother.
But it's not her. I really think she as an actress has like more range, and I feel like she's a bit like pigeonholed into this like.
She was good in Greenberg.
Oh, I hated Greenberg.
Oh well, there's a problem.
I don't think that was her though.
I need to rewatch it. I don't know how I feel about Noah Baumbach generally, and that is very
I'm
much
done with Noah Baumbach.
I'm looking forward to Mistress America, but I have a Blu-ray
while we're young,
and I have a Blu-ray, and I just like have not.
I really want to see While We're Young. I think that he's I like him generally.
Well, I really enjoy Adam Driver. I enjoy him so much.
Breaking out the sexy voice for that.
Anyway,
not in that way. I think he looks like a gross caveman. I like him. I think he's a great screen presence, and I think he's like a fairly decent actor. Actually, I'm crazy excited to see him in Star Wars. But anyway,
let's talk about Eden some more.
The film itself, I will say, like Eden as a whole, it definitely lost me during the last hour. It just kind of felt a little indulgent toward the end, where I don't know. I was just waiting for the demise to happen. Not even the demise. I think I was just waiting for like an epiphany or like a revelation or just something, and it never came. And I understood what it was going for, but I just kind of wanted it to get on with it. It just, like I said, it just felt very listless, and I don't really feel like. Felix Degree, I think that's how you pronounce his name.
Yeah,
I didn't feel like he could really carry the film for that long, like shoulder the film. I just think, I mean, he's adorable. Don't get me wrong, and
he's cute as a button.
He doesn't age apparently. So
lucky him.
But I didn't really feel. I felt like there needed to be another component. Like, you know, I really love the character Cyril, the artist. Like Eurotrash misogynist artist. I thought he was great. And I just felt like he was a good kind of like, I felt like he was a good, like he was the other extreme where he's insanely talented and is going places and has everything going for him. And then he kills himself. And it's just like, I don't know. I didn't feel like it needed to be this like dance, like electro dance epic, like, oh, we're gonna show, because it doesn't happen. Like, I mean, Daft Punk, they are characters in this film, but it's sort of, the movie is sort of happening around them, so they sort of like, the movie's punctuated by each of their hits, so it's like the beginning of their career and the sort of the middle of the career with one more time, and then it ends with Random Access Memories. And I thought that was really cool. But I just kind of felt like, why are we watching a movie about this guy who never made it? Why are we watching a movie about Daft Punk?
There was a point early on in this movie where I was bored by this film for great stretches of it. So I had a lot of my mind kind of taking control. And one of the ideas that I had was like, what if you made a movie that was like a biography of someone, but you just straight up never told anyone that that's what the movie was?
Yeah.
Like, wouldn't it be interesting to walk into a film and it's like a DJ duo tries to make it. Okay, great. And then you're watching it and suddenly like you realize that it's about Daft Punk. I was like, that would be so much more interesting. Cause
that's,
you would actually be
interested. What I thought it was. That's what I thought it was going into it. I was like, oh, this is like it's not about Daft Punk directly, but it is about Daft Punk. And then it was like, wait, oh, no, never mind. They're in the movie?
It's been, the movie's being pretty egregiously missold, is the thing.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It's being shown at music festivals, which I find really odd.
God, really?
Yeah, I just don't. It's not the audience for it.
No.
I mean, unless there are people. I mean, granted, there will be people at the music festivals invariably who will enjoy this kind of film, but yeah, it's odd.
Well,
my issue with the film is that it doesn't make me care about the characters at all. I guess that's a huge problem to have. I just didn't care. I just couldn't get behind it because it was really difficult to understand where they're coming from. I mean, this duo seemed to be doing pretty good. They have this respect show that they put on every week that seems to be getting great crowds. They're working with other artists. Like, they create some good music. They have a radio show. And it's just like, they don't do enough to show why that's not working. Like, they go around the world.
There's one scene where one guy, a club owner, says, "Oh, you guys need to do something different. There's all these other clubs doing these other forms of music, and Garage just isn't working." And I was like, "Wait, well, why?"
But there's that huge club filled with people that speaks otherwise.
Yeah. Well, and he points out that a lot of them are like invited guests. They're not paying, which kind of brings in the, like, this is a business.
Right.
You know, which I think was, I don't know. It was one of those things where I don't know. Just, I agree. I kind of agree with that where I did feel like I didn't really understand, like, oh, so they're not successful.
Right, so it's like they just have a shit ton of friends.
Yeah.
Who are happy to come out.
Who are hangers-on.
Right.
I think the movie, for me, it was never unclear as to what their level of success was. They were getting in on the ground floor on something that was capturing a popular imagination, that was capturing, to use the title of an Olivier Assayas film, that was, something in the air.
Oh, yeah.
There was something in the air when it came to electronic dance music, and they happened to be there. And that's not to criticize them. I mean, they were, you know, they were smart enough to work in it. I'm just saying that a lot of the reason they were getting attention is because they were present. But as time passes, and time passing is such a big part of this movie, it's sort of, you know, it withers away. Time
again,
is eating away at it.
It's hard to feel the passage of time when they don't age and when their level of success
there
begins.
There are title cards telling you what year it is.
That's not a good tactic.
Why not?
Because if you don't make the characters age.
Have you never liked a movie where a title card tells you what year it is?
I'm trying to think now. I'm pretty sure I have. I'm pretty sure.
Well, there's a montage at one point where you just see all of the years pop up on the screen, and the way it shows the passage of time is with these home movies of them out on tour. I think for me, I think if you don't understand dance music, because I have a lot of friends who are DJs. I have a lot of friends who are huge electronic music fans, and it is one of the most difficult to describe genres, or difficult. I think it is just such as a genre that, like, there's so many subgenres and there's so many different categories, and it's ever changing. And what works in one club isn't going to work in another club, and what works in one, it's just one of those things where it's such an insane type of music that to succeed in it is almost like it's incredible. Like,
well,
for Daft Punk
to be. I mean, I went to a rave the other weekend, and it was with a guy, a DJ, who was apparently very well respected and well liked, and the place was packed, and he had, like, a massive light show. And the girl who I went with, who was, I guess, the ferryman into this world, because I'd never really been to something like this before, was like, oh, he's great, he's, like, tours all over the place. But it's like, I recognized all the music he was playing because it was from other artists.
Yeah.
And, like, sure, there's a backbeat behind it, but that it's one of those things where even the friends of mine who DJ on the side, I never understand what it is they're adding. It's literally like, here's a dance beat, and then I'm just going to figure out a good point to fade a song in that's popular over it.
Yeah, and it is.
And
I mean,
you know, that's not slamming them because obviously it works. It's just like, it's not like, it's not as compelling as watching a guy sit down and bang out a concerto on a piano and scribble sheet music. You know, it's like, if it's impossible to understand what it is specifically that you're doing, it's hard to really care.
Well, I mean, we have Girl Talk here in Pittsburgh, which is just like, Girl Talk is like an enigma in and of itself. I think it's, I don't know, it's just one of those things where for me it was one of those things where it is, the film is about these two guys. Well, actually the one guy basically like disappears at one point, his partner,
and then he comes back, and I really honestly never knew where that guy was.
He has a wife and kid.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, at one point he has a wife and kid when they go to the when they're DJing the New Year's Eve.
Yeah,
which I was like, why? When did this happen?
Well, they didn't really care about the second guy in the DJ thing.
Yeah.
Like, the movie didn't care about him. It was Paul's show, and other people kind of flitted through it. But, Nick, to address what you had said about the title cards, like, that, it lets me know academically that we've entered a new time period, and maybe I can expect to see different phones or, like, updated computers. But I didn't feel any growth in the character. Like, the erosion, it was never present in him as far as I was concerned.
Well, he doesn't really grow, and that's kind of part of the idea. As far as erosion, I mean, for me, it's just kind of in scenes when there is just less and less attention paid to him increasingly. And, you know, he's at this party where Daft Punk premieres, I think it's Defunk, perhaps. Am I remembering correctly? You know,
Yeah.
That one. Anyway. Yeah. So he's at that moment, and
well, Nick went for the lounge singer version. I decided to try for a more honest approach.
Nick's a crooner.
Nick's a goddamn torch singer.
That's the lo-fi. No, that's the lo-fi beginning of it that you were doing. I'm doing the more like the middle of the song.
Oh, okay, I see.
Anyway. So yeah, no. For me, it's kind of this thing of, as you're moving along, and you can kind of detect that things are sort of whittling down, and I could feel that too. I think part of it is the fact that there's this one section where these year title cards are going by, and there's kind of this, it's superimposed over this blurry footage of parties happening, and the fact that time is passing over that. Again, it's that word, dread. It put a sense of dread into me, like how time is just literally slipping away. It is literally going by in a flash. And before you know it, you know, you look around and your best friend has killed himself. And nobody cares about you anymore. And you're just kind of there, sort of floating along. It doesn't matter if you were there first. You know, it's basically, I mean, this is basically a movie-length version of LCD Sound System's Losing My Edge, if you think about it. It's basically, you know, I was there, you know, and now the kids are behind me, et cetera, et cetera. And then it's just listing off all of the artists who, because, you know, I mean, this movie has a very long soundtrack. You can get the soundtrack from iTunes. It's 4.5 hours long.
Good fucking God.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're talking about, like, Frankie Knuckles. You're talking about, I think, David Guetta is, like, one of the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much name dropping in this film.
Yeah. Sueno Latino, who are over the opening credits, which I love. I love how this movie, as I noted in my review, how the movie doesn't really let you see light until music begins. I love that idea of basically the world doesn't open up to you until you hear this music. Exactly. Lost in music. I also, you know, not to get too personal here, but I also saw this movie at a time when I feel like I especially related to it in a way, which I think maybe feeds into my reaction. I mean, it does. I know it does.
You don't have to apologize for that. I mean, like, that's what art does.
Yeah.
Like, it finds you at a certain point, and if you hit it just right, it'll say something wonderful to you.
I saw it at the beginning, you know, within the first month of my senior year of college, and I was kind of, the movie had me thinking a lot about the 3 years that had preceded it and the year that was to come. It is kind of this idea of feeling yourself slip away and kind of like decay, basically.
Yeah, well, I just turned 28, so let's talk in a couple years, asshole.
Well, no. But it's about what that time signifies and how I could sense that it was going to be coming, that it's on its way. And it's the fact that I saw it and then it didn't come out until after I graduated, which is kind of interesting. I just had the movie sitting there with me, and because really very few people I know actually saw it, you know, I just kind of had it internalized there in a way.
This is something I've been feeling a lot, because I'm trying to make up my mind as to whether or not to go to the Toronto International Film Festival again, because monetarily I just don't know if it's going to work out. I've switched jobs, and I don't know what my time is going to look like. And I've been thinking about every movie that I saw there that may never see a release in America, and it's actually started to bum me out, because I really want to watch some of those movies, and I don't like living with them alone in my head and not being able to talk about them.
Yeah. I actually was thinking the same thing, Brian, weirdly enough, about going to TIFF. So, but again, I think it's actually much more expensive this year.
Is it?
Yeah. Fuck. I guess they upped the price a little bit.
God damn.
I know, right? But yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Again. Anyway, well, hey guys, when you hit 32 like me, you can look around and your life is that is a Talking Heads song. Like, how did I get here? Yeah, it is, because he's like, at one point they're dragging him up the stairs after his disastrous New Year's Eve party DJ set, and there's an old lady in the building, and she says, "Oh, kids these days," and he says, "I'm 34," and I was just like, "Oh God, I'm 2 years away from that."
I just went to a party last night where people both my age and older than me and younger me were getting wasted at the exact same level, and I was thinking, like, "Oh boy, should we be okay with this?" I have friends who have children now, like, and they're not doing this.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just one of those, and I actually think that's really, really nice that it connected with you in that way, Nick, because there's, I mean, I don't even know if I could think of a film that really touched me in a way, like, when I was getting out of college, where I was just like, oh my God, like, I need to, what am I going to do with myself? And there's so many films that are like that, too. But I think, you know, I think with having, like, such a singular experience like that is really is awesome.
Well, like I was saying, it's a good... Ever since The Dissolve died, I've been thinking to myself, how long do I have doing this?
Because
I love it, and it doesn't tax me too much. These are mainly movies that I would have seen anyway.
Yeah.
And I get to talk with very smart people about them. And I get to put it out there into the world, and maybe people enjoy listening to it. And, but that can't go on forever, can it? I mean, without beginning to make more, as I grow older, and as my, you know, responsibilities increase, it's going to become more of a premium on my time. And so it must be monetized to a greater degree, or I will have to make sacrifices elsewhere. And there's going to come a point where the scales are going to tip, and I'm going to have to make an active choice to either abandon film writing and essaying criticism, or just continue to harm myself to keep it up, because it is one of the things that I truly love doing.
Yeah.
So, well, in and that I think way, that's... the movie speaks to me, but as a film, I did not find it to be successful, which is a weird place to be in.
Well, because the curse and the gift of being a writer, of being a musician, of being anything, this is going to sound so pretentious, but it is just
dive in.
Yeah, you never stop being a writer. Like, you never stop being a musician. It doesn't stop. You retire from it, obviously. Who was it? Philip Roth retired.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm sure he still thinks about it. I'm still, it's something that like stays with him. You know, it's one of those things where like you can like stop being a waitress. You can stop being, you know, it's anything like that. But it's like, if that is the thing that grabs you, it doesn't stop. And I really think like you were saying, Nick, I think it is like this guy was at the forefront of this, this music that he loves, and doesn't want to give up on it, and you know, and he is good at it, but it gets to a point where it's just like, where is it going?
But like, if he's good at it, which I think that he is, like, what was his downfall? Or is the story that there is no quote-unquote downfall, it just never happened for him?
It's basically that it never happened, but more than that, it's that he was kind of... He was in a pool, essentially, and there are only so many people who got out of that pool into the mainstream. And I think part of it is that not only are Daft Punk very good at what they do, but they sort of make a version of it that people like the most.
So
I mean, the
Daft
scenes
Punk
of the movie
is garage, I guess.
I suppose so.
Electronica disco thing.
Not to get too much into the question of labels. It's more that, I mean, what are the scenes that you, what's the music you remember most in this movie? It's probably the Daft Punk music.
Sadly.
Yeah. Which isn't, but I don't think it's necessarily unfortunate. Like, the movie does not have contempt for them. It should be clear.
There's a couple scenes where there's sort of where it's a joke that they're not recognized at clubs.
Because they have a robot head.
Which actually, Mia Hansen-Love explains that they actually had that problem at that same club where that scene is set. It's based on an actual incident that happened. It isn't them playing themselves, but
no.
It did actually happen.
That's really... Does it happen once or twice in the film?
I think it only happens once.
Oh, really?
No, there's a part in the beginning where they make a joke that the two guys are Daft Punk at a club.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Like, this movie, so many people only get into clubs because the right person walks out of the door at the right time.
Yeah.
We're on the list. Yeah. No, you're not. Guy walks out. Hey, they're on the list. Let him in. Oh, okay, great. it's an interesting thing to do where you have this ascension in the background that's not really even looked at as a big thing because it's Daft Punk. And meanwhile, you have this guy sort of silently failing. It's like if you were to have a movie about a punk band and, you know, the Clash is rising up all around them and they're just still there trying to, like, get their shit together out of the garage and then they just don't work.
Well, I feel like there's a lot of films that are about, like, failed rock musicians. And that is an easy... I feel like it's easier to understand, this type of rock music is not popular anymore. It's just outdated. It's really hard to understand why a type of electronic music...
Well, yeah, because to my untrained ear, a lot of what they were doing in the 92 section sounds like the shit that I hear even now.
Yeah. So, well, it sounds a little rougher. I
kind of like the roughness, though. That lo-fi... It's funny what you say, Amanda, about you're never not the artistic thing that you pursue. Yeah. I've written one novel. I'm in the middle of writing another one, and I haven't touched it for like 6 months, just because, you know, my previous job was kind of a soul-sucking, tiring experience. And the last thing I wanted to do when I got home was look at a computer. My new job, I'm, you know, getting into the rhythm, and then I'll feel comfortable, like, spreading my energies around, but at the moment it's still kind of a suck on my stamina. But at work on Friday, I got locked out of my work computer because I am a contractor for the government now, doing technical editing, and I don't have a card yet. So they had me on a student computer that updated, and then it was like, hey, you need this card. And my boss literally said, I don't have anything for you to do, just sit at your desk and read a book or something until the IT guy can fix it. And I pulled out my laptop and began writing, and I put two chapters into the book and wrote what I think is probably the greatest passage I've ever written. And I was like, yeah, this never goes away. And luckily enough, it's something that doesn't require me flying in singers from America, having studio space, and all this other stuff. That's what I've always said. Being a writer is the greatest gift you can give yourself, because the barriers for entry on just like a completion level are so low. Like, still have to find a publisher, you still have to do all this other stuff, but it's not like I can't be a rock star because I can't afford a guitar and lessons. It's like, just by speaking and being able to write the language, you have made first steps that someone who wants to be a competitive, I don't know, polo player cannot do. It's helpful in that way.
If you're successful enough, you can be like Stephen King and start directing and acting in movies.
Yeah, Maximum Overdrive.
Just being a complete, wonderful idiot. Yeah, and I think like, I think with this film too, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, I understand what it's saying, but it's just so hard to, I think there were definitely points in this film where the main character was also not the coolest dude and would just say really shitty things. I think at one point they're listening to beats. Like they're trying to pick a beat for this new song, and this one song comes up, and he's like, "Oh, that sounds too feminine." It's basically just like duh, 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 duh.
Yeah.
And he's like, "It's too feminine,"
that's
and the other
deep.
Guy's
that's
like,
"Too feminine." That's too.
But after he says it's too feminine, the guy's like, "Oh, you're right. It's so thin and superficial." I was like, "All right."
Yeah, just like women. Am I right, Nick?
Thin and superficial.
When I talk about relating to this movie, you finally understand. But otherwise, it's kind of funny how. And I'm proud because I think I'm the only person who asked Mia Hansen-Love this in an interview with her, is that the main character has his sister find a tone for him, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. technically is her as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Technically Mia Hansen-Love, as a kid.
Yeah.
It's just this weird thing that came up. I don't know. It's something that I'm surprised people didn't ask her, because I thought it was like the strangest thing to like cast a young version of yourself and direct her in a scene. But
that's a good point. Yeah. I like that. Good work, Nick.
Thank you.
Oh, that's a good point. That's kind of adorable.
So yeah, I would say that people I enjoyed and still found something kind of loose and saggy about Goodbye First Love. Which was actually I reviewed for the film stage. I gave it a B. I would probably give this one like a B minus, I guess, from that same thing, because it just doesn't feel like she's tightened up, and she probably doesn't want to. But I would like it if she did. I'm not feeling.
When I spoke to her, she said basically, this is how I make stuff, and
right. I think that there are stories that can benefit from that. I just don't know that this was one of them. Like Goodbye First Love, in the way it examined how your first love will follow you through your life, mm-hmm. it benefited from that, largesse. Mm-hmm. And this one, I think, like at a certain point, I got it. Like I figured it out.
Yeah.
And I didn't need the extra hour. Which is a terrible thing to say, but...
I know, I hate being like, this movie needs to be shorter.
It doesn't need to be shorter. I just think if you're going to extend it for that amount of time, you need to do something else to it.
Well, and
I don't want to tell this person how to do their job. I know it doesn't work for me. It does work for Nick, and I'm sure it works for a lot of other people, but for some reason it just...
Well, stylistically, I think she does a lot of really, there's so many nice touches in the film. I really think that there are some really nice touches that accent the film. But as a whole, yeah, I think I wanted a little more. Because, again, this is also a very stylistic brand of music. Yeah. And it's associated.
And I didn't feel the energy of the music in the film, which is, again, the point. But it was weird.
Well, because it's being treated as... You know, we have to like compose this.
Yeah,
you know, and they're only.
But it didn't give me a better understanding about how the music is created, or I never felt his passion for it.
Well, and I do like the way he deconstructs the sound, like sounds. I think at the very beginning, he goes up to that guy and he says, "What was that one track you were playing? It was very gentle." But striking, and it had tiny flutes. He kept saying tiny flutes, and I was like, oh, tiny flutes. That's so adorable. It's so writerly. Tiny flutes. But yeah, I kind of like that.
Okay. Well, any final thoughts on this movie before we talk Blu-rays and then get out of here?
No. I think I'm good.
Okay. So, yeah, I'm going to say, like, this isn't a failure as a movie. It sets out to and does what it means to. It just didn't work for me. So people should still check it out, I think.
Yeah, definitely check it out. And I'm just glad Nick had a moment with this movie.
Yeah.
Let's all take time to appreciate that.
I do.
Okay, moving on to Blu-ray. This is simultaneously a great and terrible week for Blu-ray releases, apparently.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it's most weeks.
Yeah, I would say so. Well, there are two movies that I really want to share with people who I know didn't get to see them the first time. And there's one movie that I'm interested to see just because I'd been hearing about it. So the first two, Ex Machina and It mm-hmm. Follows, two movies that I will buy and then force all of my friends to watch.
So let me tell you something, Brian, because I know I was on the I was defending myself hardcore on the It Follows podcast.
Yes.
I was talking to a friend of mine who had seen It Follows and loved it. We were watching The Guest together. And she's like, I actually like The Guest more. She's like, I feel like The Guest is very similar in tone to It Follows, but I watched It Follows again recently and didn't like it as much as I did the first time. She's like, really? It didn't stick with me.
Interesting. Well, I look forward to watching it again and seeing what, because I really wanted to watch that movie recently. Similarly with Ex Machina. The other movie that I'm interested to see is X-Men Days of Future Past, the Rogue Cut.
Fuck you. Why?
Because I just... I'm interested to see it because I love little apocryphal stories like this where, like, they shot an entire different movie and they're putting it out now. And so I just want to...
It's that different?
Oh, yeah. Dude, it's like...
I thought it was like 4 extra minutes.
No, I heard it was... I'm pretty sure it's a substantial amount of time, man.
Well, how long was the film to begin with?
I don't know.
3 years, I think.
3 years? Okay, that sounds about right. Oh, no. I meant runtime. Is that still what you mean, Nick?
Yes, that's okay. Exactly what I mean.
Okay. Ugh.
So it's like, according to things I've read, it's anywhere between 10 to 20 minutes of different footage, and it completely changes, like, a number of plot points. Like, it's not just, oh, it's an extra scene, like... It rewrites the story itself.
The way I see comic book movies now and the way they keep revisiting the same storylines and the same heroes and redoing it, remaking it, is kind of like what Nick Nolte becomes in
The Hulk.
It's just this big amorphous, it's ever changing, but it's still kind of just this big, gooey, unattractive blob.
Well, I also love the fact that this thing is called the Rogue Cut, and yet if you look at the poster, Wolverine is still at the front of it, and Magneto is giant in the middle, and then Rogue is, like, sort of shunted off to the right in the back. Now, the terrible part. Paul Blart, Mall Cop 2, and the second best exotic Marigold Hotel.
All I'm going to say is...
And the longest ride.
Have you guys seen the Paul Blart, Mall Cop meme?
No.
Where it is the most... It is really... It's just these people who take the poster for Paul Blart and just do... It's just insane. There are tumblers of it where people just take and do, like... Not just, like parodies. It's, like... There's one that's just Flesh Mall. And it's just... It's just, like, Paul Blart as, like, a big hunk of flesh on a Segway, and, like, the mall is made out of flesh, and stuff like that, where it's just, like, horrifying, like, ridiculously hilarious. The best thing that came out of Paul Blart 2 is the meme.
I'm looking at this now.
It's kind of, like, a lot of them are just, like, surreal and ridiculous.
Paul Blart, Blart cart. Half Blart, half cart. Don't mess with his mom.
Anyway, don't see the movie. Just look at the meme. I know I don't usually promote memes. But yeah. This is like high art of memes.
I don't even know what to think of this. I'm looking at it now. We need to leave.
I love it.
So yeah, I would say check out Ex Machina and It Follows. We also have Hiroshima Mon Amour coming to Blu-ray.
Oh, nice.
Great. The first 20 minutes of that movie in HD. That sounds... Have you guys seen Hiroshima Mon Amour? Do you guys...
I have not yet, no. I might buy the Blu-ray, actually.
The first 20 minutes intercuts Emmanuel Riva and her lover having sex with the most horrifying aftermath footage of the Hiroshima bombing.
Oh, sweet. That sounds...
Now
I'm not so excited.
That sounds great.
And then just for curiosity's sake, I'll probably check out the Rogue Cut.
Jesus. Okay.
I should also
buy it. Jesus, guys, calm down.
But it's still time out of your life that you're taking to watch that film a second time. Anyway, I want to also... There's a 2014 release here, The Salt of the Earth, which is a Wim Wenders documentary about Sebastio Salgado, a photographer who chronicled, in addition to just these... incredible images of nature in its, you know, purest habitat, also the worst of humanity, just these atrocities, these genocides and wars. And the documentary is quite good. I actually have a review of it coming in the next issue of the British film magazine Little White Lies. So,
oh wow,
you can look for it there. But also, the movie is really strong. So
it was his son was the producer. I'm trying to think.
Co-director.
Actually. Co-director. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would totally see that. It looks beautiful.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's honestly some of the most beautiful images I've ever seen are in that movie. And I say that as someone who sometimes wonders if they're dead inside, because it's not often I look at images of nature and feel much, because I sometimes just... honestly, though, because a lot of times I look at them and I just kind of don't have a sense of being there. But the way he captures them with, like, this really stark black and white contrast, and like these, a lot of times it's these overhead shots that are taken from a helicopter, so it's just so expensive. Mm-hmm. It's really stunning. I actually know people who bought his book after they saw this movie based solely on what they were seeing here. It has that kind of effect. So, yeah.
Paul Blart Pop Tart.
Thank you, Brian. Jesus.
I'm sorry. Nick, it's kind of, I'm like thinking about actually like looking at nature, and like unless I'm in it, I kind of have the same reaction.
Well, yeah. Thanks.
So you're not alone.
Thanks, Ron Swanson.
Yeah, I mean, you're damn right. Breakfast food, woodwork. Anyway, it's 10:30 on Sunday night. Mm-hmm. It's time for us to say goodbye. We will be back next week to talk about The Tribe. And I'll have seen Ant-Man, so we can, if anyone else sees Ant-Man, we can talk about that.
Oh, perfect. Perfect combination. Ant-Man,
I would so readily get plastered and go to a showing of Ant-Man. I would totally do that. Okay. I'm not sure if I'm going to, but perhaps if I can wrangle... I'm not going to do it by myself, because that sounds horrifying, but
I can... Just a lone drunk guy in a movie theater.
Yeah, on a Tuesday.
Get small. I told someone in my office, they were talking about how like it some of the trailers they're showing still say not rated, not yet rated.
Uh-huh.
And
ooh,
I told him, I was like, well, I can understand. I've already seen the movie. I was, you know, because I told them that I get to see movies early every now and then. I said, it's actually pretty violent. There's a point where he shrinks himself down, jumps into a man's mouth, and then becomes full-sized again to blow his head up. And he said, oh my god, really? I was like, no.
I thought for sure you were going to say he jumps up his urethra.
Oh god.
And I was like, please don't say urethra.
No, into his mouth. But then I was thinking, I'm like, that could work. Like, why doesn't he do that? So we'll see. Awful. We'll see what that happens. So and we'll talk about Ant-Man for a little bit. I'm hoping to see Trainwreck as well.
Oh yeah. I'm hoping that we have a completely silent podcast in honor of the tribe.
Podcast will be done completely.
Da, 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 da. There we go.
All right. Well, you can find more of our episodes at thefilmstage.com. Feel free to comment on the pages where these are posted. Also, give us a comment and a rating on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at Filmstage Show. Amanda Waltz, where can we find you online in the meantime?
You can find me at Midi Waltz on Twitter. I also have a few kind of newish reviews on the film stage right now. And I'm going to write a couple more here coming up.
Cool.
And you can also read my Pittsburgh film blog, Steel Cinema, on WordPress. And that's about it.
Nick Newman.
Thefilmstage.com, Twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and the hottest clubs in Paris, spinning my new record. It's going to get them going.
Is that the name of the record? It's going to get them going?
No, it's currently untitled.
Oh, is it your DJ duo?
My DJ duo? I don't know. It depends on who I'm doing it with, I guess.
It's called Taxi.
I think if I did it with Danny King, it'd be New King.
Ooh.
Or Kingman. Something like that.
I like New King better.
Yeah. New Kingman?
New Kingman?
I get
nah,
that.
New King. It's punchy.
New King, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. On that note.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. Also doing stuff on the film stage. And that's about it. That's all that you need to know. So, ladies and gentlemen, join us next week when we'll be talking about a melange of films that have absolutely nothing to do with each other aside from basically being released around the same time.
Released.
Released. I know.
What accent even is that?
Tired. I think it's tired. It's not like when I said Renaissance.
Renaissance.
What was the word you fucked up? Candelabra?
Yeah.
And you called it like candelabra?
Candelabra.
Yeah.
Aww.
Well, also, it was the same episode, Soderbergh, because I also said contagion.
Yeah.
Did you have a stroke, Nick?
Because those words aren't that commonly used, so I just didn't...
There was another word you fucked up in that podcast, too. I can't remember.
There was an episode where I said chaotic, and I meant I didn't know that it's pronounced quixotic, and then I got really mad because that makes no sense.
There was also an episode where you called something... a three dicks box set.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome to the Film Stage Show. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you, and listen next week.